From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Are all these stories right about the fact that these elections will be fraudulent, they'll be fixed, they'll be rigged, and everyone's looking at it. And a lot of people are saying, you know, that probably will happen.
As President Trump floats the idea of delaying the November election, we look at many of the questions surrounding this year's contest. Will an election even happen? Will President Trump accept the results if he loses? Will mass disenfranchisement help Trump win? We'll speak with a member of a bipartisan group who gamed out what a contested November election might look like, and with a voting rights activist in Georgia. Then to Morocco, we'll speak to the award-winning journalist and human rights activist Omar Radi, who is arrested last week on what press freedom advocates call retaliatory charges. Amnesty International reports Radi's phone was hacked using Pegasus spyware from the Israeli company NSO Group.
I was the person who has been spied on. The least I wanted from the government is to launch an investigation about what was happening. But I have been, the next day, I have been attacked and aggressed and accused of treason and many other insults that tried to discredit me with the public opinion.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. death toll from the coronavirus pandemic has topped 155,000, as the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 soared in July by nearly 50%. On Sunday, top White House coronavirus advisor Dr. Deborah Birx appeared on CNN and warned the country has entered a new phase in its fight against the pandemic.
What we're seeing today is different from March and April. It is extraordinarily widespread. It's into the rural as equal urban areas. And to everybody who lives in a rural area, you are not immune or protected from this virus.
Over the weekend, California became the first state to record more than 500,000 confirmed COVID-19 cases. California reported 219 deaths on Friday, a new single-day high. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 death toll at San Quentin State Prison has reached 20. This comes as more than 7,000 people in Southern California have been forced to flee their homes due to a massive wildfire east of Los Angeles. A new report in Vanity Fair reveals a White House task force led by Jared Kushner abandoned a nationwide coronavirus testing plan in the spring for political reasons. One public health expert in frequent contact with the White House official coronavirus task force said, quote, "The political folks believe that because it was going to be relegated to Democratic states, that they could blame those governors, and that would be an effective political strategy," unquote. In news from Capitol Hill, negotiations over the next coronavirus stimulus bill remain at a standstill. Republicans are refusing to support renewing a program to give unemployed workers an additional $600 a week in benefits. The enhanced benefit expired Friday. In other news from Washington, Democratic Congressmember Raul Grijalva has tested positive for COVID-19 just days after he chaired a meeting attended by Republican Congressmember Louie Gohmert, who refused to wear a mask and later tested positive. In a statement, Grijalva said, quote, "While I cannot blame anyone directly for this, this week has shown there are some members of Congress who fail to take this crisis seriously," unquote. Meanwhile, CNN is reporting the Republicans are considering barring journalists for the first time from attending the upcoming scaled-down Republican National Convention, citing health concerns. The global death toll from the coronavirus is approaching 700,000, with nearly 18 million confirmed cases as the pandemic continues to accelerate. During the month of July, more than 8 million people tested positive, almost as many as in the first 6 months of the pandemic combined. The World Health Organization reports cases are now doubling every 6 weeks. In India, the death toll is top 38,000, the fifth highest in the world, surpassing Italy. One of India's top officials, Home Affairs Minister Amit Shah, has been hospitalized after testing positive. The Philippines reported over 5,000 new coronavirus infections Sunday, its largest single-day increase on record, bringing its total confirmed cases to over 100,000. The authoritarian President Rodrigo Duterte announced he's reimposing a stricter lockdown around the capital, Manila, as medical workers around the country warn the healthcare system could collapse. In Australia, a state of disaster has been declared in Victoria, which has instituted a nightly curfew to fight the outbreak. The coronavirus is still surging in South Africa, where over 500,000 have now tested positive for the virus. Medical workers say the surge in cases has brought South Africa's healthcare system close to collapse.
The cracks that have been there even before coronavirus are getting bigger every day. Our healthcare system, public healthcare system is failing. Our people, it's failing the entire country. It was not ready for this virus.
In Arizona, Border Patrol officers raided the medical camp of humanitarian group No More Deaths Friday, detaining 30 migrants. This was the second such raid in just 2 days. The camp provides water, food, and medical attention to refugees crossing into the U.S. through the scorching Sonoran Desert. Last week, No More Deaths published documents revealing the Border Patrol Union, a pro-Trump, anti-immigrant extremist group, had instigated a 2017 raid of the same camp. Volunteers say their phones were confiscated and border agents disconnected power to the property's only water source. In a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court said Friday President Trump can move ahead with building his U.S.-Mexico border wall using $2.5 billion in military funds while the legal battle to stop the construction continues. The Sierra Club and other groups argue Trump circumvented Congress to divert the funds and that the border wall will cause irreparable environmental damage. In more immigration news, the Trump administration will start charging fees to apply for asylum. This is a penalty against asylum applicants, an anonymous asylum officer told BuzzFeed News. The U.S. will charge $50 for asylum petitions and joins Fiji, Iran, and Australia as the only countries that require people to pay for seeking legal refuge. Citizenship and Immigration Services will also hike up the cost of other immigration services, including an 80% increase in the fee for applying for U.S. citizenship. In Afghanistan, at least 29 people have been killed and 50 others wounded after gunmen raided a jail Sunday night in Jalalabad in Nangarhar province. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack, which comes a day after one of its senior commanders was killed by Afghan forces in the same region. In Zimbabwe, the author Tsitsi Dagarembwa, a Booker Prize nominee, was released on bail Saturday alongside several others after being arrested for holding anti-government protests. Authorities had banned a Friday protest, which was calling for an end to corruption and a worsening economic crisis. But Dagarembwa still staged a two-person action for which she was arrested. Fadzeyi Mahere, a lawyer and spokesperson for the opposition movement for Democratic Change Alliance Party, who was also released on bail, filmed her arrest.
Riot police are coming at us and they're armed. Riot police are advancing towards us for the protest.
Rights groups are warning the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa is intensifying its crackdown on critical voices, comparing his tactics to former strongman leader President Robert Mugabe, who was ousted in 2017. Hong Kong has postponed legislative elections, citing the pandemic as it intensifies its crackdown on opposition leaders and critics. A dozen pro-democracy candidates were blocked from running, including prominent activist Joshua Wong. This comes as Hong Kong has issued arrest warrants for at least six pro-democracy figures under its new national security law, including a U.S. citizen, Samuel Chu, who works at the D.C.-based Hong Kong Democracy Council and lives in the United States. Microsoft says it's in talks to acquire U.S. operations for the popular app TikTok after Trump said he would ban the Chinese-owned video-sharing platform. Reuters is reporting Trump told Microsoft it has 45 days to close the deal after he previously said he opposed the idea. This comes amidst ongoing tensions between the U.S. and China over the coronavirus trade and the situation in Hong Kong. TikTok says it has 100 million users in the United States and does not share its information with the Chinese government. President Trump has installed a nominee for a top Pentagon job in another nearly identical position after the Senate abruptly canceled his hearing last Thursday when it became clear they didn't have enough votes to confirm him. Retired general and Fox News contributor Anthony Tata, Trump's pick to be the next Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, will now instead be performing the duties of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a temporary position that does not require Senate confirmation. Tata has come under bipartisan fire for promoting Islamophobic conspiracy theories, including calling former President Barack Obama a terrorist leader, calling Islam the, quote, most oppressive, violent religion I know of, and as well pushing a conspiracy theory that former CIA Director John Brennan ordered the assassination of Trump via a coded tweet. A federal appeals court overturned the death penalty sentence of Joe Kartsonaev, who was convicted of the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings, after the court determined the judge in his case did not thoroughly review jury members for bias. Tsarnaev will now have a new trial to determine his penalty. The attack killed three people and injured hundreds of others. An active-duty U.S. Army sergeant has been identified as the man who killed anti-racist protester Garrett Foster in Austin, Texas, last weekend. Daniel Perry said he acted in self-defense when he opened fire after driving his car into a crowd, but eyewitnesses have challenged this account. In June, Perry retweeted a post by President Trump referring to protesters as anarchists and lowlifes, adding the comment, quote, "Send them to Texas. We will show them why we say don't mess with Texas," unquote. Meanwhile, in Portland, Oregon, racist and anti-police brutality protests continued this weekend, now entering their third month as federal agents drew down their presence last week after a widely condemned violent crackdown on demonstrators. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the Homeland Security official, whose office put together intelligence reports on protesters and journalists covering protests in Portland, has reportedly been removed from his post. Brian Murphy was reassigned to administrative role within the agency Friday. The intelligence reports compiled information on two journalists from the New York Times and the blog Lawfare, respectively, who published leaked documents about DHS's tactics to repress anti-racist protesters, as well as some of the protesters. In Michigan, a court of appeals freed a 15-year-old student Friday who'd been locked up since mid-May for not doing her online schoolwork, pending an appeal of her case. Students have rallied behind the teen known simply as Grace to protect her identity, saying she was unfairly targeted because she's Black. And in New York City, sex workers and their allies took to the streets Saturday for the Black Sex Worker Liberation March and Vigil. Among protesters' demands were the decriminalization of sex work and a repeal of the so-called walking while trans ban, an anti-loitering and anti-sex work law that activists and rights groups say is disproportionately used to attack trans people.
This work is the only work that has allowed me to regain agency over a body I was taught to hate my whole life.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said Sunday the November presidential election will proceed as scheduled. That's after President Trump faced bipartisan outrage last week for suggesting delaying the election. Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Senator Lindsey Graham, and even Stephen Calabresi of the arch-conservative Federalist Society spoke out against the president after Trump tweeted Thursday, quote, "With universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It'll be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote," unquote. But President Trump has not taken back those comments. They came as nearly all polls project Trump will lose against Joe Biden in November. Mark Meadows backed off Trump's claim on CBS's Face the Nation, saying, "We're going to hold an election on November 3rd, and the president is going to win." This is not the first time Trump has suggested he'd oppose the election process. He was asked about accepting the November election results during an interview last month with Chris Wallace on Fox News.
"I think mail-in voting is going to rig the election. I really do."
Are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election?
I have to see.
Can you give a direct answer? You will accept the election?
I have to see. Look, I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no. And I didn't last time either.
For more on the many questions surrounding this year's election, we're joined by historian Nils Gilman. He's vice president of programs at the Berggruen Institute and co-founder of the Transition Integrity Project, or TIP, which organized a bipartisan group of experts to game out what a contested November election might look like. Nils Gilman, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you respond to President Trump's tweet, which he has not taken back, no matter what Mark Meadows says? He's talking about the illegitimacy of mail-in votes, and he's talking about delaying the November election. This is something you've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah. Well, you know, he has tweets a lot of things, and it's not clear how seriously one should take any of it, of course. I think what's striking about this one, of course, is that it got a lot of bipartisan pushback, which is good, because obviously we don't want to have the president not get pushback when he's saying that he wants to delay the election. But what's striking is how many of his tweets don't get bipartisan or at least Republican pushback. So when he says that, you know, mail-in ballots are going to be fraudulent, there's no pushback against that from the Republicans. So I think that tells you where the limits are about what they're willing to tolerate from the president.
So talk about what your group is doing, Transition Integrity Project, and the simulation gaming out that you did in June.
Yeah, so last month, or actually, I guess in June, 2 months ago now, we ran a series of four what are known in military circles as war games, which are basically simulations of possible outcomes, not so much of the election, but the aftermath of the election between November 3rd and Inauguration Day on January 20th. So we looked at four different scenarios, Biden winning in a landslide, Trump winning in a landslide, and a couple of scenarios where the election was very close or actually truly ambiguous. And we assembled a group of people who played different roles. They played, some people played Team Trump, some people played Team Biden, some people played Democratic elected officials, Republican elected officials. This was a bipartisan group, included people, you know, a former Democratic presidential chief of staff, John Podesta, former Republican vice presidential chief of staff, Bill Kristol, you know, a Democrat, former Democratic governor, Jennifer Granholm of Michigan. So it was a high level group, bipartisan group. And we tried to find out what could potentially go wrong between Election Day and Inauguration Day. And the results were pretty intense. In every scenario except for the one where Biden won in a landslide, we ended up with severe electoral contestation, protests in the streets, you know, crazy stories happening on social media. And the challenges went down to Inauguration Day. The contestation was really without precedent.
Wait, so go through these four scenarios.
Yeah, so one scenario was, you know, Biden wins wins pretty big. And by the way, you know, we started simulating the game, the games the day after the election. So we didn't simulate things that could go wrong on the day of the election. There's lots of other people who are concerned with that. We were specifically focused on what could happen after the election. Are there possible ways that the transition process could be disrupted? And the reason we needed to do that was that the United States has a very unusual electoral system where people don't take office immediately after the election. There's this 10, 11-week period between Election Day and Inauguration Day when the incumbent government, the lame duck government, is still in power and still can control things. And that was one of the things that was really striking. Trump will still control the levers of power, even if he loses the election, for 10 or 11 more weeks. And this allows him to get up to all sorts of mischief in terms of deploying the Department of Justice, the post office, you know, Department of Homeland Security in ways that can disrupt the transition process.
So talk about the role of the swing states, for example, like Michigan, and what role they could play.
Yeah, so there's a series of swing states, Michigan, North Carolina, and Wisconsin are really the three striking ones, where you have a situation where there's a split government. You have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. And because of the way in which election certification works, there's a possibility to do all sorts of kind of corrupt things during that period. So basically what happens is the votes get counted, and then typically what happens is the state legislature has to certify that one side won the election, and then the governor sends a slate of electoral votes to the Electoral College, which gets counted in mid-December. And then the Electoral College sends on its results to Congress, which has to certify the results in early January. So because there's this split in these swing states between the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor, you could end up with a situation, and this is what actually happened in some of the simulations that we put together, where the vote happens one way, the Republican legislature certifies it another way, and the Democratic governor decides to send in a third slate of electors. So you could end up with competing slates of electors being sent, some by the Republican legislature and some by the Democratic governor. And this, in fact, is there's a precedence for this. This exactly is what happened during the contested election of 1876. You had three states then, I believe it was Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana that year, that sent competing slates of electors to the Electoral College. And at that point, it becomes up to Congress to decide which of the competing slates of electors they're going to certify as being legitimate and counting for the purposes of selecting the next president.
If it was clear that Trump lost the election, would the military or could the military or Secret Service just walk him out of office if he wasn't leaving?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, at some point, you know, if he refuses to leave the White House physically and everybody agrees that he's lost, at that point, he's effectively just a trespasser in the White House. And presumably the Secret Service would remove him. But I think the real question we have to worry about is not whether it's totally clear and everybody agrees other than Trump that he lost. If that situation happens, I'm not too worried that, you know, the situation will resolve itself in an orderly manner. The real cause for concern is if there are competing narratives that large numbers of Americans believe about who actually won the election. And that's actually, unfortunately, very possible, especially given how polarized the electorate is and the competing narratives about the kinds of frauds that can take place around the election. Trump is already promoting the notion of fraud. He'll say he won if he wins, despite the fraud. And if he loses, he'll say he lost because of the fraud. I mean, you had the clip at the top of the hour here when you were playing the introduction where he says exactly that.
So he just has to create a plausible narrative that he didn't lose, you say. And what would that do?
Well, if he creates a plausible narrative, and by plausible, I mean something that, you know, gets picked up in social media and then gets parroted on Fox News and gets, you know, picked up maybe by the Wall Street Journal op-ed page, that the reason why he lost is because of, you know, fraud that's happening in some of these swing states or, you know, as he would say, illegals voting or the mail-in ballots or, you know, foreign interference. There's any number of different channels for creating a narrative that there has been fraud. And if he can do that and he can convince enough people on his side of the aisle that narrative is true, then you have a situation where there really will be two different stories about who won the election. And that obviously can create a very dangerous situation.
So Trump's attack on mail-in voting comes at a time when the Trump administration is facing accusations of sabotaging the Postal Service under the newly installed Postmaster General, who happens to be a Trump fundraiser, Louis DeJoy. Can you talk about what this means? Since DeJoy took office, he's instituted a number of cost-cutting measures that have slowed down the delivery of mail. The Washington Post reports there's now a days-long backlog of mail across the country. Take it from there.
Well, I'm not an expert about exactly what's going on at the post office, so I can't speak to that, but I can talk about what the risks are. There's going to be an unprecedented number of people voting by mail, voting absentee this year, partly because of the coronavirus epidemic, making some people concerned about going and standing in line in closed quarters to go vote. So many people are going to vote by mail. If the mail is slow, then the mail will be delivered late and these ballots will not arrive on election night. One of the things Trump has also been claiming, which there was no pushback on from Republicans, is that the election should be called on election night. Well, why would he want that? Well, it's because there's a well-known phenomenon among people who study these things closely known as the blue shift, which is that the votes that come in late tend disproportionately to be Democratic voters for a whole bunch of different reasons. And so, obviously, if he wants the election called on election night, that would prevent any of the votes that came in late by mail, by the mail that's being slowed down by the Postal Service's, incompetence, from being counted. And so it's effectively a form of disenfranchisement of anybody who votes late or votes by mail because they're afraid of the coronavirus or for any other reason that people might want to vote by mail.
Of course, I mean, the front page of the New York Times today, lag in tallying mail-in ballots raises alarm. New York City is still deciding the June primary races.
Right. I think one of the things we really need to get ready for is that we're not going to have a traditional election night. It's really going to be an election season. And one of the things that I think the media really should be getting out, the word out to all Americans right now, is that, you know, we need to be patient, and we won't necessarily know the result on election. I mean, it's possible that Biden will win in a landslide or Trump will win in a landslide, in which case we will know. But there could be a number of different states. So, you know, the swing states, even though Biden's way ahead in terms of the national polls, in the swing states, the results are still pretty close. And we may not know on election night who won. We may not know for, you know, a week or even 2 weeks afterwards as these ballots trickle in and have to be counted carefully. I think it's a responsibility of all Americans to be patient about that, because what we want above all else is for our, you know, democratic voting process to have integrity, for everybody who wants to vote to be able to, and for everybody who votes to have their vote counted.
Finally, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm has said states should prepare for a worst-case scenario for a November election, including Trump seizing ballot boxes and using the military. Do you think that's possible, Nils Gilman?
I do think it's possible. I mean, we've already seen, you know, what he's done in Portland, and it's kind of sinister from my perspective that, you know, even though he's now withdrawn from Portland, withdrawn the federal forces from Portland, he's announced that they're going to be deployed in specifically Cleveland, Detroit, and Milwaukee. Why would he pick those three cities? Well, those are blue cities in swing states, in Ohio, in Michigan, and in Wisconsin. And if he can prevent and intimidate voters from voting in the biggest blue city in each of those states, that could be decisive in swinging the results in his favor. So I do think that, you know, there's a severe chance that the military will be used, or, you know, militarized forces. I don't think the military itself, I think after Lafayette Square, the military itself is likely to resist being deployed that way. But we have, you know, paramilitarized federal forces that are prepared to do Trump's bidding. And I do think that that's a severe risk for the election.
Nils Gilman, I want to thank you for being with us, historian and co-founder of Transition Integrity Project, which organized a bipartisan group of experts to game out what a contested November election might look like. When we come back, we'll be joined by Latasha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter. Stay with us.
Nobody turn me around. Don't let them turn me around. Don't let them turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, yeah. Keep on talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom's land. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Don't let them turn me around. Don't let them turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, yeah. Keep on talking, yeah. Marching up to freedom's land. Well, the first thing
that's our next guest, Latasha Brown, singing Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around as she witnessed Congressmember John Lewis's last journey across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in her home native, her native home of Selma, Alabama, that took place last weekend. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As President Trump trailed in the polls last week, he tweeted Thursday he's floating the idea of delaying the 2020 election, that it would be, quote, the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Hours after Trump tweeted, former President Barack Obama delivered the eulogy at John Lewis's funeral in Atlanta, where he called for sweeping changes to expand voting rights.
Even as we sit here, there are those in power who are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting by closing polling locations and targeting minorities and students with restrictive ID laws and attacking our voting rights with surgical precision, even undermining the Postal Service in the run-up to an election that's going to be dependent on mail-in ballots so people don't get sick.
Former President Barack Obama giving the eulogy at the funeral of civil rights icon John Lewis. Well, for more, we go to Atlanta, where we're joined by Latasha Brown, co-founder of the Black Voters Matter Fund and the BVM Capacity Building Institute, 2019 Harvard Institute of Politics Fellow. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Latasha. It's great to have you with us. So there you are, singing at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, watching John Lewis's casket being carried across cross in a carriage of two black horses. You're a leader in the voting rights movement. Can you talk about Trump saying that mail-in votes disqualifies elections, that they're fraudulent.
You know, it's so surreal, the moment that we're going through, as I think on the backdrop of, you know, all the work and celebrating the work of John Lewis and other advocates and civil rights leaders who did so much to secure the right to vote. And then we've got this other, this dichotomy where we have a president who is probably the most fascist president that we've ever had in this country. And fundamentally, you know, when I'm thinking about his tweet, I think it has a couple of reasons that he did it. One, he knows he doesn't have the power to do it, but that hasn't stopped him before. I think he is hell-bent on pushing the boundaries, whatever he needs to do to undermine and undercut democracy. The second thing he does, which is very similar to what we saw in the voting rights movement, is that he wants to create an environment of fear, a culture of fear. And so he goes out and he makes these tweets so that his base can get all up in arms. He can already set the stage for what he plans if he loses, as he knows that he's not doing well on polls right now, that it also sets the tone for that, so that he creates that kind of confusion. And the third thing I think that he does is that he wants to create kind of a confusion among voters in general. He wants to dissuade voters from feeling that it is possible in this election cycle. It's almost like a distraction. You know, I do notice that the day that he did it, you know, this is when we had the highest number of cases of COVID-19 that were reported that day. And so I also think that he has a really masterful way of wanting to change the subject so he can change the news cycle. That oftentimes when he's actually coming under pressure in the news cycle, what he will do is he will say something racist or very inflammatory so that it shifts the news cycle. So I think that it was a combination of what he said around all of that. But just like you heard in that video, it's just not me. There are millions of Americans who have been taken to the streets, you know, over the last couple of months, who are saying we ain't going to let nobody turn us around. And so he's got to deal with what he has underestimated. He has really underestimated the power of the people. And so ultimately in November, you know, I think what he thinks is his best tactic is to literally create enough doubt so that he can create confusion and that in some way he can actually create his base where there's to undermine the results of the election cycle.
According to reports, the number of registered voters in your state of Georgia is approaching an all-time high. An article published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution says there are nearly 70,000 more voters in Georgia today than there were in May. About 30% of the voters said they were Black. What do you attribute this massive increase in voter registration to?
You know, I think people are paying attention in ways that we haven't been paying attention, that Americans haven't been paying attention before. We have been devastated by COVID-19. There are millions of people right now that are without their jobs. We now have a Congress and a Senate that refuses to extend the unemployment benefits. People are demanding something different. They are fundamentally frustrated with the process. They're seeing all of this act right before their eyes. Trump has failed to show any leadership. And what we're seeing is record numbers. I was out somewhere the other day at a grocery store, and I don't really go out that often. And there was a young person that walked up to me and asked how could they register because they had recognized who I was. I've also been getting those kind of text messages. I've never gotten this kind of response from people who are actually coming to me. Usually we're going out trying to get people to register to vote. But folks have been calling me, young people in particular. So I think we all see what's happening in this country. And I think people are starting to get a sense of how critical this election cycle is, not just because to move Trump out, but because he is actually creating harm in our community.
And of course, that came after the meltdown primary in Georgia. You know, the former Secretary of State, who's now the governor, Brian Kemp, doing everything from around coronavirus, copying Trump and not wanting to impose any kind of statewide mask mandate, to on the issue of voting, continue to challenge votes. Now, Stacey Abrams raised the issue of the amount of money or the lack of money that's being put into these stimulus packages for voting in November. Do you think, Latasha Brown, that Democrats in Congress are doing enough to ensure a free and fair election and ensure that people have access to the polls, especially mail-in voting, and educated about what that means?
You know, I don't think that there's enough being done. I do think that there are some Democrats who have been champions of this process, and I admire them and I lift them up in their work. But we've got to stop looking at this as a partisan issue. This is a democracy issue. So fundamentally, what we have to do is we've got to press all of those in Congress, even those on the outside. We've got to put additional pressure on our elected officials, whether they be Democrat or Republican, to say that we want a free and fair election, that the people deserve that. And so what I am not seeing is I am not seeing the level of intensity around protecting and ensuring that we have a free and fair election that I think we're going to need. It is clear that we have an administration who plans to steal this election. It is clear that we have an attorney general who is complicit around this, and also the Republicans. So I think that we need something far more intense, far more far reaching. And I think we need to, every day there should be a press conference by the House or by Democratic members talking about the dangers of voter suppression every single day. And so I'm not seeing it at that level, but I know that there's some that are fighting.
Latosha Brown, you were one of seven prominent Black women who wrote an op-ed in The Washington Post headlined, "Biden Still Needs Black Women. Here are three things he needs to do." He is expected to choose a candidate, a vice presidential running mate, any day now. You wrote, quote, "Biden's only path to victory is through Black women and the voters we know how to energize. Though we have propped up the Democratic Party for decades, the return on our investment in the party might as well read insufficient funds." You went on to outline the 3 points for Biden, which were America needs a Black woman as vice president, America needs a Black female Supreme Court justice, and America needs a comprehensive Black agenda. Expand on this.
So I think that what we need to recognize, and I think we know that for the last 50 years, particularly for the Democratic Party, Black women have been the most consistent at the highest turnout base in any constituency group in this country. Yet in the last 50 years, we've not had a Supreme Court nominee of a Black woman. We have not had a Black woman in the highest positions as president or vice president, or even nominated or considered as president or vice president. In addition to that, what we have seen is we've seen underrepresented representation of Black women, and not only just political office, but political appointees. And so we are demanding something different, that as we're going into this new phase of American democracy, that those who are on the front lines, who are protecting and who have always been on the vanguard of protected democracy. We stood 100 years ago with our white female counterparts, although our own vote wasn't secured till 50 years later, that we have consistently been on the vanguard of pushing democracy. However, we have been completely underrepresented. And part of it is not just because I think that the time is now, even though I do think that where in the world, if someone had showed up for 50 years and they're not considered in the top two or three positions, I mean, that in itself, if it was a white man, it would be unconscionable. But aside from that, we're in a moment right now that Black women, we know that we are in a space around racial tensions, racial division in this country, and we really need a depth of understanding around structural racism. We also need someone who has a depth of understanding around gender issues. Black women sit squarely in the space of gender and race. One, I think that there's a particular offering that we bring to this process, that Biden actually needs a Black woman to actually bring some excitement, some energy to the ticket, and a depth of knowledge and experience. And any of the women that are on the list, I think, actually can meet that. But I think it's a critical, fundamental issue that we have to talk about. What happens when you exclude populations, particularly those populations that have consistently showed up for you? And so that's where why I am continuing to stand on this is the moment. You know, I think it's interesting that when Biden said he was going to select a woman, no one questioned that. Why didn't anybody question that? Because we knew it was the time, that we knew it based on having this environment that we're in right now, that it was natural for him to say that there was time for a woman to lead. Does the saying not apply to, in this moment that we're in right now, a Black woman would bring a critical voice to this process and bring a certain level of energy and expertise?
Latosha Brown, I want to thank you for being with us, co-founder of the Black Voters Matter Fund and the BVM Capacity Building Institute. Thanks so much for joining us. When we come back, we speak to a Moroccan journalist, human rights activist who has just been jailed. Stay with us.
Yes, the rhythm's a rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the end.
Pause by Public Enemy. Chuck D just turned 60 this weekend. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to Morocco, where authorities have arrested the award-winning journalist human rights activist Omar Radi on what press freedom advocates are calling retaliatory charges. Omar Radi reported on the role of Moroccan state and big business in dispossessing farmers of their tribal lands. He's spoken out about facing harassment and surveillance. He was arrested on Wednesday, July 29th, just over 1 month after he was the focus of an Amnesty International report that alleged Moroccan authorities hacked Radi's phone using Pegasus spyware from the Israeli company NSO Group. Now a court has charged him with undermining state security by receiving foreign funding and collaborating with foreign intelligence. The court also just charged him with rape. The Committee to Protect Journalists issued a statement that, quote, Moroccan authorities in the past have plainly tried to make any charge against him stick in retaliation for his work as a journalist. CPJ called on them to release Radi and investigate any sexual assault charges in a credible and transparent manner, unquote. Omar Radi's lawyers deny all the charges against him. He's reportedly being held in a prison in Casablanca that's a COVID hotspot and has not been allowed any visitors, not even his lawyer or his parents. His next court hearing is scheduled for September 22nd. I spoke with Omar Radi before his arrest and the latest charges on July 16th when he was being taken in several times a week for questioning and asked him to explain what was happening.
First, it all started by a media harassment by pro-state media that started leaking my private information and also saying fake news about me and insulting me, my family, my colleagues, and my friends with a lot of fake news, but also with real news, my bank information, for example, that only state officials can access to them. So this harassment campaign accused me of being having worked for intelligence agencies, especially U.S. and British intelligence agencies. And surprise, the June 22nd, Amnesty International released its report about me being spied on by Moroccan authorities using the Pegasus virus. 23, the next day, the prosecutor, the general prosecutor of Casablanca, ordered the National Brigade of Judicial Police to investigate with me on the basis of the same information that has been leaked on this pro-state media about me having been a spy for I don't know what country. So 24, I got the police summons, and 25, I had my first hearing by the political police in Morocco, and it continued. And now I'm one out of 2 days at their offices answering ridiculous and surrealistic questions, such as, "You have met with the spokesperson or a diplomat from the Dutch embassy. What kind of intelligence and services were you providing him?" And without any evidence, they don't face me with any evidence. They just ask me questions like that are empty questions. And they want me to confess something I didn't know. And now it looks like harassment, and everybody in Morocco knows it is a judicial harassment for what happened with Amnesty.
So let me step back for a moment. Omar, can you talk about your work as a journalist, the kind of stories that you do?
Yeah, this year I worked a lot on land dispossession because in Morocco we have collective land ownership and the tribal lands are very, 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 very large in Morocco. And the state is trying to get these lands and to inject them into the market. And there is a lot of injustice in these policies because people are not compensated well. And these lands are re-evaluated very highly. And it's all benefits to the big capital in Morocco, actually. So I work on land grabbing, land dispossessions. I also work on the finance sectors and the relationship between the power and business in Morocco. That's my framework, and also human rights.
And so then explain what this Pegasus program is, how you believe, I mean, the government in Morocco has access to your bank accounts and other information, but what happened to your phone?
Pegasus is quite silent program. You don't feel it, actually. And it's not a persistent program. It doesn't stay in your phone or in your computer. It works using a network injection. So people need to be near you make themselves pass as a relay antenna. And your phone is connected to a fake relay antenna. And then the network injection works, and then the program works, and they get, I don't know, he has a lot of features. He can use your microphone, he can use your keyboard, he can use your screen, and get any information that is stored in your phone. So I don't know what the amount of information they stolen from my phone, but I'm sure in this state medias, they published many information that I have exchanged even in Signal, which is known that that is a very safe program. So I have evidence that my own conversations have been leaked to pro-state media, the same that are leaking also my bank information.
And can you talk about what happened specifically when the Amnesty report came out, the significance of what they said, very much focused on your case, and then what the Moroccan government said to you when they started calling you in for these interrogations, and what have you been charged with?
In the police, they don't talk about the Amnesty report. The government said in a public statement, an official statement, the head of the Moroccan diplomacy said that I have been used as a pawn by Amnesty International to harass Morocco, that is a democracy, and that I myself, I have ties with an agent, liaison agent from another country. And this was really serious because it's the government in person who is threatening me and accusing me of all this while I'm just, I was the victim here, and I was the person who has been spied on. The least I wanted from the government is to launch an investigation about what was happening. And I was even okay to give them my phone to audit it. But I have been the next day I have been attacked and aggressed and accused of treason and many other insults that tried to discredit me with the public opinion.
Omar, if you're charged with treason, could you face the death penalty in Morocco?
Criminal code articles, yeah, it's large, and I don't know. I think they have no evidence against me, and this is an empty case. But if they want to charge me, I can go from 1 year, 5 years to of prison to death penalty. But I think it's unlikely. This is a This is not really serious because the state they cannot consider that I'm an individual. I'm in a war against all the institutions. I'm not in a confrontation with the state. I'm an individual that needs to do his journalism in a safe way, and people let me do it in peace, and also to let me express myself as I want to. I'm not in a war against anybody, and the state thinks that I'm going in a war. This is surrealistic, and I don't
know.
Are
you worried about the people around you, closest to you? Can you talk about who they are attacking and revealing who are your friends, your colleagues, who you live with?
Yeah, the very last surprise, for example, was that my father's phone calls have been transcribed in this pro-state thug medias.
Wait a second.
So
your
even
father,
my father has been...
Transcripts of your father's conversations are printed in the
phone
Moroccan
calls.
Media?
Yeah, yeah. So now even my father is phone taped. So this is crazy. This is taking proportions that are incredible.
So let's talk about when all of this happened. The Amnesty report says forensic artifacts that Amnesty International extracted from your phone suggest that the Pegasus network injection attacks occurred on January 27th, the February 11th, and the 13th of September 2019.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what they found, because the virus makes disappear its fingerprints, so it's hard to find all the traces of this of the active virus, actually.
Now, we spoke to you in March, shortly after we first spoke with you. You were given a suspended 4-month prison term for a tweet that you put out in 2019 about the jailing of a group of activists. What were you tweeting about?
There were this strong social movement in the north of Morocco, the Hirak of the Reef, and its leaders were asking for hospitals, job opportunities and public services. And they ended up jailed, some of them for 20 years of jail, of being accused, like I'm accused now, of jeopardizing national security. And I tweeted about this judge, and I said, we will never forget about all these people with no dignity. And I have been accused of outrage to a judge and sentenced to 4 months suspended. And I went to the appeals. I'm still waiting for the appeals date.
Do you assume you are always being surveilled, Omar?
Yeah, I have evidence about that, actually, because the police showed me that I was they were surveilling my phones and my calls and my SMS messages since 2011. The investigation with the police went back until 2011. So they knew who I was talking to, who was texting me, who was calling me, etc. It's not a speculation. It's not a supposition. I am now sure that I have been surveilled by the state. The state in Morocco has a good track record of acquiring this kind of tools. Hacking Team, Finn Fisher, BAE Systems, Morocco is a customer and bought. And we have the proofs and the evidence that Morocco have paid more than $3 million, for example, to Hacking Team, the Italian company, for its virus remote control system, RCS.
Omar Radi, how is the Moroccan media covering what's happening to you? What are other journalists saying? Is civil society rallying around you?
Yeah, civil society is rallying around me, and I think the public opinion is very, very showed a lot of solidarity, as well as the Moroccans living abroad and many other NGOs in the international level. Medias also are, precautiously covering the facts of what's happening and waiting to see the next steps. Except the pro-state media and what I call the thugs that are working as a journalist for the state, that are they already sentenced me. They already called me the spy, the traitor, etc. Those media are in their role. I think they just were functioning as state thugs.
Do you think that the Moroccan government is using you, Omar Radi, as an example, a warning to other journalists not to do the kind of corporate and state investigations that you do?
I think I think what we've done with many other journalists in the past is has upset the state, and the state, in its strategy towards the media, decided not to make this happen again, and not to make it repeat again, and not to make this kind of journalism exist. So yes, I think it's revenge actually, and it's a very fast reaction after the Amnesty report. But also, it has this function to make people afraid by this kind of courage, of this kind of journalism, this kind of people who speak out and who call call out against injustice, etc. I think this is considered as dangerous by the state.
The first Amnesty report showed examples of this Pegasus software injected into other journalists' phones, documenting, surveilling, spying on everything they were doing. What advice do you have to working journalists?
Yeah, we cannot have the means of states and huge companies, huge defense, cyber defense companies. I think the best thing to do is to get a lot of precautions, not to use the phone if it's not necessary, if we can do the things physically, etc. Protecting sources as journalists is very, very important because on one of the purposes of the surveillance is to access, to map your network, and using the latest security software and anonymity connections. I think this is very, very important.
And Omar, does it make sources afraid to talk to you? You are a targeted journalist. Has anything happened to people you spoke to for your stories?
I didn't try to call them yet because I'm always in the police offices. I need to go back to my work, so I hope to see what's happening after all this nightmare is over.
We are speaking to you right before your sixth interrogation tomorrow. Are you concerned at any point, like tomorrow, you could be taken and not released?
Everything is possible, actually. It's not excluded. But if they arrest me, they have to show material evidence, which they don't have. So it would be an abusive arrest. And my lawyers are aware of all that. And I gave all evidence and all the proofs of my innocence to my lawyers and all my partners, to journalists, etc. So I'm not afraid. I'll go there. I stopped answering their questions and I stopped signing their reports since yesterday. And I'm not doing it again. So I stopped cooperating with the police because they're asking empty questions and questions that don't respect the presumption of innocence. So I'm not playing this game. If they have something, they just arrest me and send me to the prosecutor and then to trial. But I'm not playing this Q&A game with the police that just want me to confess that I was something I never was. So I took this very hard decision, not keeping silent and not signing any testimonies or confessions.
You said you've made this decision to keep silent?
Yes, yes. I'm not cooperating with the Moroccan police.
Award-winning journalist and human rights activist Omar Radi speaking to us from Casablanca, Morocco, July 16th. 2 weeks later, on July 29th, last Wednesday, Moroccan authorities arrested him. He's reportedly being held in a Casablanca prison that's a COVID hotspot and has not been allowed to have visits from his lawyer or his parents. We'll link to the Amnesty International report that alleges Moroccan authorities hacked Radi's phone using Pegasus spyware from the Israeli company NSO Group. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Stay safe. Save lives. Wear a mask.